Adam, how'd you get hooked on airplanes?
Well, David, it was really due to my grandfathers. One was a B-17 radio operator in the Pacific. The other was a Marine. And growing up, they would take my brother and me to museums, to air shows. And we just fell in love with that era. But we didn't want to just read about it. We didn't just want to see the aircraft. We wanted to communicate to our peers, our schoolmates who were clueless to this stuff. So we started a newsletter about veteran stories. And that little newsletter grew into a magazine. And the magazine led to what I do now, which is I write books. And I'm just a hero worshiper. I mean, that really is what it is. It's about. I see something in the veterans of World War II, Korea, Vietnam, values that I think would help us today.
Tiger Cats. Get around to talking about Tiger Cats.
Is that what they came out to listen to?
Well, apparently.
That's what this is.
Yeah. Adam, how much do we know or do you know about the role of the Tiger Cat in the Pacific War, World War II?
Well, the Tiger Cat arrived almost too late. I say almost because it got there the day before Japan surrendered. So, you know, it's technically a World War II veteran. It was developed in 1941 all the way through the war. So, yeah, it's a World War II plane, but it really got its, earned its name in Korea. And it's such an appropriate aircraft for the Korean War. There's these similarities when you see Korea is just this unknown war. You know, when you see a veteran with a Korean War ball cap, a lot of people don't know, you know, what were those battles about? Where did he fight? All we know is MASH. I mean, that's really the standard for the Korean War. It's not very good. And it's the same way with the Tiger Cat. What was its use in Korea? What did it do? Yeah. This was a night fighter, primarily, and it was put to use in these interdiction missions. Basically, cutting the supply lines of the communist forces. A lot of people thought that this was the jet era. An aircraft like this would have been completely obsolete. There were people that talked about abolishing the U.S. Navy at that time.
Where did that come from?
It came from the GDP, mostly, of the United States. At the end of World War II, we were spending 40% of our GDP fighting that war. And after the war, we had to cut back. And Truman went crazy, and he started just hacking programs. So we went from having 98 carriers down to 15. And there were people that were saying we should have zero because the atomic era was upon us. So if you're going to fight
They were really talking about abolishing the Marine Corps and the Navy?
Yeah. Why would you ever need an amphibious assault ever again when you have the atomic bomb? Why do you need an aircraft carrier? It can't accommodate a long-range bomber. So they said, let's make the Navy into cargo ships. Let's make the Marine Corps part of the Army. And we don't need planes like the Tiger Cat because, you know, we're going to have these F-80s and these F-9Fs and the jets. But they found out that when they actually got into the combat in Korea, there were a lot of things the jets couldn't do that this machine could step up and do.
What were the other weapons primarily in the Korean War besides this airplane, and how long did it last in terms of being used in Korea?
Well, when the Korean War broke out, we were really caught flat-footed, and they were scrambling. So they brought Mustangs, P-51s, F-51s up from Clark Field in the Philippines. The Valley Forge carrier with its Corsairs was rushed into the theater. They were gathering up Mustangs from the Air National Guard units stateside. They even had to go to Germany to the depots there to get iron bombs to fight the war in Korea. We were so unprepared. But those aircraft came in, and they held the line. They prevented the Allied forces, the Americans and the South Koreans, from being pushed into the sea in the summer of 1950. And in the process, they annihilated the North Korean Air Force. And they stepped up and they showed that, for example, these F-80s, these jets over in Japan, everybody thought they're going to save the day. Well, they couldn't fly out of the muddy Korean airfields. And by the time they made that flight across the Sea of Japan, they'd used up so much of their fuel that they couldn't loiter very long. Whereas the Corsairs and the Mustangs, they just put them down onto Korean soil and they went to battle. The P-47, however, was left home due to those budget cuts after the war and also due to the idea, what was a P-47 good at? It was good at tactical air support. It was good at smashing tanks and so forth. Well, who's going to need that in the atomic era? You know, they just wrote off the P-47 altogether. So they didn't have enough parts or planes to really get involved in the Korean War. But so in the early days, it was the World War II stalwarts that carried the weight.
Was there any kind of a stalemate in Korea?
There was, and it happened. We thought we were going to win that war. We thought we were going to have it over by Christmas. And the Chinese kept saying, if you come close to the Alu River, we're going to jump into this thing. Because China never wanted to see a democracy on their border. They never wanted to see a unified Korea. And that was their big fear. And MacArthur downplayed. He said, we're going to drive the North Koreans across the border. We're going to unite the country. And the Chinese ambushed us. And basically, air support allowed our forces to pull back to the 38th parallel, back to the starting point, basically. And the war became a static sort of war of attrition. And during that time, the Tiger Cats, of course, would go behind the lines. They were very useful for smashing bridges and also for smashing these narrow gauge railroads, because the jets with their bombs couldn't get slow enough. They couldn't be accurate enough. Their speed was too much. So these guys were great at smashing enemy supply lines. And another place they came really in handy, when you're fighting this war of attrition, at night the North Koreans would send over their washing machine Charlies, bed check Charlies. They were little Russian PO2 biplanes. And these biplanes had been used in World War II by the Russian Night Witch pilots. They would harass the German troops. They were female pilots. And so the North Koreans took that out of the Russian playbook, and they would send these biplanes over. They'd load them up with 5 100-pound bombs. The little thing could only, you know, coast along at 95 miles an hour, and they would harass our troops up and down the DMZ there, the 38th parallel. And so it doesn't sound like a big deal, but when this plane comes over, the searchlights come on, the anti-aircraft starts firing, the sirens start wailing, the guys in their foxholes and trenches try to shoot because they're trying to search for this plane in the dark. It succeeded in keeping our guys from sleeping, wearing them down. It was stressful. You didn't know if that bomb was going to fall on your head. And ultimately, they needed a plane that could deal with those guys. And the Tiger Cat, fighting at night, using its radar to track down these slow-moving biplanes, it could do what the jets couldn't, because some of these jets, the F-94 and so forth, their stall speed was 110 miles an hour. And this little biplane is motoring along at 95 miles an hour. And so you have stories of jets stalling out, squadron commanders getting themselves killed, trying to take out these little biplanes. You have stories of guys actually hitting the biplane and then flying into the wreckage in their jet because the speed differential was so much. So this aircraft was able to navigate through the darkness, get to the right speed, and fight those little washing machine Charlies, piston engine on piston engine.
How many human stories have you pulled out of Korea that you've written about?
Well, I focused on one in particular. It was an incredible Navy story, you know, that branch of the service that shouldn't have existed at that time. It was a story of Tom Hudner and Jesse Brown, two Navy pilots. Tom was from the country club scene of New England, and yet he wanted to fly for his country. Jesse Brown was a sharecropper's son from Mississippi, and he went on to become the first African-American naval aviator. So they were very uncommon wingmen for 1950. And they went overseas, and they were fighting to save our Marines at the Chosin Reservoir battle, that battle where the Chinese jumped into the war, caught us by surprise, and suddenly the 1st Marine Division is surrounded in far north North Korea, and they called them the Lost Legion. And back home, the newspapers were preparing the American people for the annihilation of an entire division. I mean, imagine that if you woke up and news from Afghanistan, oh, there's an American division encircled and about to be destroyed. That's what people were facing in November and December 1950. And our heroes, Tom and Jesse, went in with their Corsairs, and they delivered this air support that allowed the Marines to escape, to live, to fight another day. But in doing so, Jesse Brown was shot down behind enemy lines, crash-landed on a mountaintop. And the amazing thing about this, and why I say it's the one story I've just dwelled on, I wrote a book about, Tom Hudner did an incredible thing that day. His friend Jesse was trapped in his aircraft. He couldn't get out. He was in the snow behind enemy lines. Enemy troops are moving toward him. And Tom Hutter knew Jesse had a wife back home. He knew he had a 2-year-old daughter. And he's about to watch an American pioneer die far from home. And Tom Hutner did something that has never been done since. It had never been done before. He said, "I'm going in." And everyone else thought, "What is he talking about?" And Tom Hutner took one of those Corsairs, and when you walk around and take a look at them, it's a big machine. And he took it and he put it down on the mountainside. He basically made a carrier landing on a mountain alongside of his friend Jesse Brown. He got out into that snow to try to save his friend's life. And he earned the Medal of Honor for that. We lost Jesse Brown that day, but those two men gave us an example that has resonated through the decades.